Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Pulp Movie Podcast. Today, we're talking about the 2018 sci-fi crime action film Hotel Artemis. It's written and directed by Drew Pearce, who was the writer for Iron Man 3 and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, as well as Fast and Furious Hobbs and Shaw. He's also writing and directing the upcoming Fall Guy remake. It stars Jodie Foster. And I'm just going to mention the things that she's been Academy Award nominated for. Taxi Driver, Nell, Nyad, which is something that came out last year I haven't even seen yet. And then she won Oscars for The Accused and Silence of the Lambs. She's also in this season of True Detective. Very timely. Sterling K. Brown. He was in The People vs. O.J. Simpson, This Is Us, as well as Black Panther. Sophia Boutella, she was The Mummy. She was in The Atomic Blonde. And she's also in Rebel Moon, that's on Netflix right now. The man, the myth, the legend, Jeff Goldblum. He's The Fly, Jurassic Park, Independence Day, Thor Ragnarok for the kids. Brian Tyree Henry's Paperboy, 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 getting that Paperboy in Atlanta. It's also in the recent Bullet Train and the kind of stinky Eternals. Unfortunate about that. Jenny Slate, she's the annoying sister on Parks and Rec. She's also been in House and Lies, and she's a long-term voice on Bob's Burgers. Zachary Quinto, got a start in Heroes. He's also Spock in the Star Trek reboot. Got an Emmy for his work on The American Horror Story. Charlie Day, you know, he's Charlie Day. You'll know him from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He's also written the stage play The Night Man Cometh. He's also in Pacific Rim. Finally, Dave Bautista, professional man mountain. He's in Guardians of the Galaxy, Blade Runner, Glass Onion. He's in Dune Part 1 and 2. This is kind of like a type of commission podcast in that we're talking about getting our producer Talitha in the front of the house, you know. In front of the mic, in front of the cameras, and she suggested this as a movie that she wanted to talk about. So I'm gonna turn the tables over here to Talitha and say, Talitha, tell us about this movie, and why'd you want to talk about it?
Sure. Well, I try to get everybody to watch this movie. I think it's underrated and a little bit unfairly criticized. It's not a perfect movie, but the criticisms I read of it, I don't necessarily agree with. It also got buried beneath the releases of Hereditary and Ocean's 8. So when it was coming out, there's a lot of focus on other big movies. And this one sort of just slipped by without a lot of people noticing. I think people who like action, who like sci-fi, or a blend of those two, especially fans of John Wick, could really find things they like about this movie, just like I did. And I just want more people to see it. So that's why we're talking about it today.
Yeah, I remembered this movie coming out and being kind of interested in it and seeing like, oh my God, look at this cast. It looks really slick. And then when the early reviews came out and it was kind of dismissed as like a John Wick clone cash-in type of deal, my interest in seeing it kind of waned. Jim, what's your kind of relationship with this movie? And then I guess we'll get into what we think about it.
This whole relationship is new. It's the first time I've seen it. I didn't know anything about it really going in, except Talitha had described it, the cast to us. And I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. I like all those people, but I didn't really know anything about the premise. And I found that to be positive going in because I was constantly surprised by the things they were doing. And I was really impressed by the world building, by the acting in a lot of places, especially Jodie Foster. I found the movie a really easy watch in that way that like John Wick can be, where you just kind of get caught up in it. Don't think too much about it. Just have fun. And yeah, it was really good.
Yeah. And it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's like,
yeah,
maybe 100 minutes long. Just a kind of breezy hour and a half. And I will compare it to movies like Dread. I don't think it's quite as good as Dread, okay, but in like it almost feels like a bottle movie, and that you've got the single location that's very much a character unto itself, and these characters kind of traversing up and down. the like I was super impressed with the acting. It's, you know, there's a lot of talent here on screen. It's interesting how much of the DNA of this version of Jodie Foster's character wound its way into True Detective Night Country.
Yeah.
Like, it's very much, she's just kind of like swaggering, blue collar, tough old granny in both of those roles. I think the reason it keeps it from getting to the highs of like a Dredd or a John Wick is that some of the internal connections don't quite pay off as much as I was kind of hoping they would. Or there's like some of the set pieces don't quite connect as well. But like, you know, this guy is pretty raw in terms of like, you know, his movie making career. And this is also like what I consider a shoestring budget. I was shocked to see this movie only cost like $15 million to make.
And with, like, the people who are in it?
I was going to say, like, the people had to be soaking up a lot of that that price tag too. So like, the movie has no right to look as good as it does. And yeah,
and shooting was only 33 days.
Right. I noticed it was a very compressed production schedule too. Maybe that's how they got all those big names into that. You know, they didn't need them for a 6-month shoot. But yeah, I think for what he's able to pull off, it was pretty big bang for your buck. And I do think this movie, like I said, it is underrated. When you go and you read anyone talking about this film, either contemporaneously or now, it's always like, oh yeah, wasn't it that kind of like John Wick knockoff? Wasn't that kind of like the store brand John Wick? I wonder if this movie wouldn't work better in like the John Wick universe. So like, they wouldn't have to do so much independent world building. They could just get on with the characters within the universe. But like, honestly, they felt like this movie builds a lot off John Wick. So like, they don't have to explain, oh, there's a secret hospital that only serves powerful criminal warlords. Yeah, sure. Okay. Why not? Like, that's something in the cinematic lexicon now.
Yeah, it has a lot of connections to John Wick as far as structure, I guess, too, where you've got this backdrop of the riots that are happening in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The water wars, as I'm calling them. John Wick tends to have that with assassins, right? You've just got a shitload of assassins coming after John Wick.
Yeah.
This felt like it was kind of mirroring that. The riots.
Yeah. I think that structure also is where this world differs, because John Wick is dealing with people who are really slick and really powerful. And I felt like not everybody here was. Mm-hmm. John Wick is very much indestructible. So even though we have the hotel, we've got the background of unrest. Once we get to the characters, I think that's where those two movies split. So everything else looks very similar until you start getting to know people and people start getting hurt and they actually start racking up a body count, which you don't. John Wick, he takes a beating, but is he like really getting hurt? Is he indestructible? Like,
yeah.
Especially talking about like just the first movie. Mm-hmm. He seems immortal, and these people seem very not. They're very human.
He's getting more immortal as he goes, I feel.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's no spoilers for the last movie, but
yeah,
yeah, there's power creep happening.
I think that like it's a good way to think about this is, if what if John Wick was actually about John Leguizamo, where it's like John okay. Wick,
wow,
is about his body shop, right? Like, John Leguizamo is mobbed up okay. and connected, and okay. you know, obviously the underworld sees him as an important resource. Mm-hmm. But he's just a guy, you know, yeah. like he's not John Wick and he's not a criminal boss. He's just kind of like a middleman. He provides a valuable service and people respect him up to a point. This, like, Jodie Foster is like that John Leguizamo, where she's running this shady, you know, well, not even shady, just like sophisticated underground hospital. But she's just a gal, you know. Mm-hmm. she's not can't like crack three necks in 2 seconds. She can't kill an armful a room full of assassins with a pencil,
but she has some tech backing her up that,
and she's got an orderly
makes her almost superhero like
name but, is yeah. Everest, that helps too. He's mm-hmm. played by Dave, so it's like, yeah, having 500 pounds of muscle standing in your corner never helps or never hurts. But like, I think it's interesting that like the central focus of the character is on a person who is just a person in this universe. And they have all these big, powerful people swirling around them.
I think yeah, that I, goes I, into one of the themes where people, like Sophia Boutella's character says, you can't pick what you're good at. And life has driven all of these people together. So, yeah, just like Jodie Foster's character, she's caught up in this whirlpool of insanity, like you pointed out.
Yeah, I did. There was a lot of like really interesting, like darkly philosophical one-liners that I felt like this Drew guy just kind of like keeps a, you know, keeps a notepad. And anytime he has like something that seems like it should be, he heard it off of Fight Club or something like that, as he jots it down. But there's a lot of like just one badass one-liners, and also the whole like, you got to work with what you got, not what you hope for. You know, they bought your death. Don't give them your dignity for free. There's like all this like sick shit that people are saying to each other.
I'll hunt you down and unheal the shit out of you.
Unheal the shit out of you. Yeah,
that's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah,
there's a lot of those. I've probably got like as many more to flash out, but it's a good time. This movie's a good time. And I'm kind of like, I was somewhat curious to see what the Fall Guys remake was going to be about, because that was one of my dad's favorite shows growing up, and I watched it a lot with him. Lee Majors as a stuntman in California solving crimes, you know. I think that this guy's written and directed it. It's kind of like toward the top of my list of like, yeah, I want to see what he does with the Fall Guy remake. Although he did write the worst Iron Man of all time, I will hold that against him. what the hell, Iron Man 3? What the hell? Okay, shall I kind of describe the setup of this movie, and we can talk in-depth spoilers?
Yeah, let's get into it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. And now, back with more Bald Move. Hotel Artemis is set essentially 10 years from 2018, but I think it's like it'll work for the foreseeable future. You can just say it's 10 years in the future. America has been further taken over by corporations. America has been further privatized. The water system has been privatized, leading to wide-scale water riots in some of the drier areas of the United States, including L.A. L.A. is gripped in the middle of a water riot. It's this wide-scale unrest or shit exploding. And they are having a bad night, bad Wednesday night at the Hotel Artemis as a result. Opportunistic criminals are trying to pull heists in the middle of it. They're getting shot up. They're going to Jodie Foster's front door and saying, patch us up. And there's like a nexus of assassins and criminals seeking refuge. And the kingpin of L.A. ends up checking in. there's a powder keg. How's Jodie Foster going to navigate it with and keep her health and sanity in check? Because also against this backdrop is the tragic figure Jodie Foster herself, who lost her son to an apparent drug overdose and has this haunted quality that she's just trying to like make up for, the inability to save her son. So that's kind of like the premise of the movie.
The title of this movie is a bit of a misnomer. I was expecting this to be a sort of refuge, but I was not expecting it to be a hospital, because this is primarily a hospital and it has a limited number of rooms. The Hotel Artemis has a limited number of rooms that clients can come to, and the clients have a membership that they maintain. And if you don't maintain the membership, you're not allowed in. And so that was a little surprising to me that this was a hospital.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be like, when I heard it's a kind of a John Wick knockoff, I was expecting it to be literally like an unbranded The Continental, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a hotel where there's, and it is, like, it really is. Uh-huh. It has like, it is The Continental, because it's got the same rules, you know. You got to pay the fee, got to be a member, you can't hurt anybody there, you can't take the business off the streets. There's like all these, it's essentially that, except for they also have 3D liver printers and robo-surgeons, mm-hmm. and all this like near future tech that I thought was really cool.
Yeah. I'm looking at the timeline and I'm saying, are we going to be there in 10 years? Some of the stuff, yeah, maybe.
The microwave scalpel.
It also
scalpel.
Made me... Sure, yeah,
really
microwave
that.
Scalpel.
That
3D printed
favorites.
Organs, that's something that like it wouldn't surprise me if someone said you could print a liver, especially a liver. Like, I feel like a liver is like, that's... If you get like a golf ball size of liver out of somebody, you can almost grow a whole new liver just from that. So it's like, I feel like the liver is almost 3D printing itself. So it just needs a little help.
Sure.
I thought it was interesting that you could 3D print a gun out of a machine that has materials labeled as bone, tissue, and organ. That is like some David Cronenberg type gun shit.
Existence kind of stuff.
Do you want to maybe start our discussion with Jodie Foster and her character, the nurse?
Sure.
What do we think of Jodie Foster? I mentioned that I got so much of... Because I haven't seen a lot of Jodie Foster. I mentioned offhand, like, at the beginning of the True Detective season, that she hasn't really been in much except for, like, this other movie I can't even remember. She's in this Nyad that's about, I think, helping training a retirement age late gal to swim the Florida barrier islands or the keys of Florida. And she's been in this, and now we're talking about this. And now that we are, it's like, there's a lot of control C, control V from the nurse character to Liz Danvers in True Detective season 4. Are you guys getting that? Or is it just me?
Oh yeah. Especially with the picture of the sun on the nightstand.
Yeah.
Right.
The general sense of grief that she carries, it's grief and it's urgency are the two things that I feel like she's wearing on her sleeve when she's operating, and she's working with a vengeance as if she could save everyone, and you get the idea that there was someone she couldn't save. And then the urgency, I think my favorite part of her performance is the walk she created.
Yeah, that's really good.
Nurse. That like very fast shuffle. Where it's somebody who's used to a different body than what they have now, is the idea that I was getting.
Are you saying she has 3D printed legs?
Probably. Pull up the pant legs and it's bone tissue and guns all the way up and down.
It's interesting. I saw Ferrari over to Christmas break, and Penelope Cruz is playing Ferrari's wife. And she plays it with a very head down, stumpy, shuffling bulldog kind of gait too, which reminded me a lot of Jodie Foster in this. I thought it's interesting that Jodie Foster has a lot of Debbie Downer energy, you know, like the SNL Rachel Dratch character. Just her haircut, the kind of shade of like brownish gray it is, just her general frumpiness and dour demeanor. Like, she is a bit of a downer throughout this movie because she is so... grief-stricken over her son.
Yeah, clearly traumatized. She can't go outside. She hasn't been outside the hotel in several years. I get the impression that even then it was a rarity the last time she went out. I think she's great. So you compare her to the True Detective stuff. I don't think the personality is the same. I think they're very different. Like, yeah, they both carry baggage, and it's related to trauma of lost child. But the way it manifests is totally different. The performance here is really quirky, along the lines of like a Tilda Swinton kind of character. I could see her doing that role. Mm-hmm. And I found it really, just really interesting, you know, the way like her trauma was manifesting. She's still very good at what she does, but you feel like there's some kind of weight there that is affecting even her movement. I don't know. The walk does so much. The walk is really good. And the way she speaks too, every once in a while you can hear her break into like what I think of as Jodie Foster, just kind of her normal voice, but she's putting on some kind of, it's not an accent so much as it is just like a cadence to her voice.
Yeah, it's very like working class. You could see her as like working a surgical floor mm-hmm. of a hospital or something, you know. The other thing is like, I think this role requires her to be kind of vulnerable and frail, but also kind of like with the underlying toughness and steel, because she has to like back down these big tough dudes that want to disrespect her facility, disrespect her rules. Again, helps that she's got Dave Bautista standing right beside her, but like if she was a pushover, it's like you get the feeling that like her rules are the only thing to kind of keep her safe and keep her like, if yeah. she wasn't the person that would be like, I will shove you out this facility and let you die on the street if you're not following the rules, then, you know, no matter how bad the situation, you're gonna have to go through the gun scanner, you're gonna put your guns away, you're gonna have to make sure you're paid, you're gonna have to come through the door one at a time, and if any of that stuff doesn't happen, door slam shut, you're out the street and you're dying. I thought that was a cool facet that she has that steel that Jodie Foster sometimes brings to the role.
How spoilery do we want to get right now? Because
we're spoiler free, baby. We're done with the recap. If you haven't, if you wanna watch this, then turn off now and come back to it.
Spoiler free as in like guns free?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Like weapons
well,
free
fire away.
Doesn't mean put your weapons away. I mean start spraying okay. lead. Start spraying spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah, spoiler free usually means no spoilers, but okay.
Ah, I see.
So the other thing that she has backing her up here that really gives her a lot of authority is the blessing. I mean, the implicit blessing of the Wolf King, which, I mean, that's got to go a long way with people who know who the Wolf King is. And it seems like everybody does.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting that like they didn't fully flesh that backstory out. So you don't exactly yeah. know how all of those things connect, but you do know they connect enough that the like kind of the revelations that they want you to go on towards the end. And I almost wonder if like in the back of his mind, he kind of wanted to have a trilogy of stories or more stories where it's kind of like, you know, you want Jodie Foster's character to be a little bit mysterious, or maybe it's designed to be an anthology, or maybe he just had the one and done. But yeah, that she, you don't really know what her background was before, but her son, you know, she had a son who became a police officer, or
no.
He wasn't. So, he was just he just best friends with the police officer. He stole the guy's car.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which, why the
I think
fuck would
he was
steal
an
the
addict?
Wolf? I thought he was something. It's like, why would he steal the, yeah. So he steals the Wolf King's car. The Wolf King kills him and the cops say that he overdosed.
Yeah.
And then the Wolf King comes in knowingly taking advantage of, because like I guess after that she became like a street nurse where she had like a poor outreach clinic, people come in, but she also started drinking and maybe got in a little trouble with some malpractice. That's what I'm saying. I don't know exactly how, but the Wolf King says he saw this person that could be so useful, so he swept in there, you know. And maybe the implication is, did he kill her child because he wanted this outcome, or?
So I'm glad you brought that up, because that's,
because you've seen
this
more times than us, so.
Yeah, probably like 5 times by now. That's part of the movie that doesn't make sense, and I don't know if that's intentional or not. I think what the writer's trying to tell us is that Jeff Goldblum, who's playing the Wolf King, odd choice for a gangster, but I ended up really
perfect.
Also,
choice.
Incredible restraint perfect. For him not to howl once in the movie. Yeah. I really thought we might get like a sexy awoo, and when he was kind of sort of hitting on Jodie Fisher Foster, but no, didn't.
So when he's being sedated and she's asking him questions, the story that comes out of his mouth doesn't really make sense chronologically if you're thinking he killed the son to get Jodie Foster, because I think it just happened and he saw an opportunity, but the way
like fate.
He was telling it. Yeah, I think it was more fate, but the character being a narcissist and vain, like he admits, I think he likes to tell himself that, oh yeah, I orchestrated this. I killed your son before I even knew you, so that way you could run
my butterfly
penthouse. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that. And plus he's also high as fuck, so he also might be embellishing things or making these connections. But that it was confusing, because I thought they were telling low-key the story of him doing like this cosmic billiards thing where it's like, I'm going to kill the son to get the nurse, to be in the hospital. I think it also could just easily be interpreted as his grandiosity, thinking that he's just plucking the threads of fate expertly for maximum
benefit. I might have missed something, but I interpreted that differently. And maybe it's just because I like Jeff Goldblum and I want him inherently to have some redeeming quality, but I was under the impression that he felt guilty about killing the kid, and so he gave her this hotel to run. Like, guilty about killing the kid and driving her to, you know, the depths that she was at.
I see where you're getting that, but I don't think so, because he also says he never regrets the killing, only the lies. And he was following his own rules there. Steal from him, he drowns you in the ocean. Or, according to him, gives you back to the ocean. But I see where you got it.
Okay. I have another question around that. The visions that Jodie Foster is seeing throughout the movie of her child, there are two characters in those scenes, both of which are her child.
Yes,
one of which is her young child leading her to the body of her older child who's dead
at
the hands of Jeff Goldblum. Okay, it's a little confusing. I'm not used to seeing a character lead you to themselves, but I think I got the point.
I think this was the benefit of me watching this like five or six times over 5 years. Is one of the things Jodie Foster says is, when she's talking to Mo, the police officer, they're talking about Bo, the son, is they remember him as a happy kid jumping on a trampoline. And that's the way she wants to remember him, as a kid. And I think that's why we're seeing the kid and the guy who looks late teens, maybe early 20s, at the same time.
I interpreted it as
like
Jodie Foster.
And she says that's not how I remember him.
Yeah, I interpreted it as her as like having a lot of fond memories as of a mom walking to Boardwalk, walking to beach, and then also juxtaposed with seeing her son's corpse at the same place that they used to play as children. I'd be like, it's like, you know, I got a playground that was like a half mile from my old house, or, you know, I took Jack from 3 to 8. It would be like really fucked up to, you know, go to a crime scene and see him lying dead on that playground like 15 years later. That's how I, it's like she was seeing both things, like the happy child and then the tragic result of it.
I thought it was something where she had an idea in her head that something, that there might have been a lie here, that he didn't OD and die, that something else happened, and that the child version of him was leading her to that conclusion, kind of trying to free her from whatever guilt she felt about him ODing. But I'm reading too much into it.
I'm a big Death of the Arthur guy, so fuck Drew Pearson, what he intended. Yeah. You got it. So like, I think that's as valid as anything else.
But no, I understand why I might be going too far with that, and I think your guys' explanation works probably better.
I really like the fact that like you kind of assume Sterling K. Brown, Waikiki, is going to be the protagonist, because you kind of like start the movie with him, but by the time you get to the hotel, like, there's the, you know, almost right away, you know, the Wolf King's coming, and Zachary Quinto is making all these crazy demands, so you know it's kind of like Marcellus Wallace in Pulp Fiction. Like, he's a big deal. Just got Charlie Day, and he's kind of a crazy guy, but you don't know if he's like bad or evil. You've got this like super hot assassin lady played by Sophia Boutella, and you know she knows Sterling K. Brown. They might have had a previous relationship. Sterling K. Brown's got his brother, who's like, you know, Brian Tyree Henry, so he's really likable, but he also seems like he's a fuck up. There's like, you don't have really any, and there's Dave Bautista, who's kind of like a blank slate throughout the whole movie about, like, you know, what is his motivations, why. You get more little breadcrumbs later on. I really like how it's like everything's kind of a blank slate, and it's it kind of works a little bit like the movie Clue, and that, you know someone's going to break bad, someone's going to have some kind of betrayal, so, but you don't really know who or where it's going to come from.
Yeah, I found myself really enjoying all of the little connections that were being made between characters, and just the construction of this movie. I mean, from the world building stuff, where it drops little hints about, you know, the water wars in the background, and how, well, I think like halfway through the movie or something, you get the idea that it's been privatized, and that the prices are super high, people can't afford it, so that's why the riots are happening. But between the characters, yeah, I think one of the most interesting, or I guess like engaging parts of the movie for me, was the relationship that obviously existed at some point between Sterling K. Brown and Boutella. The way they kind of drip feed that, I think, is super interesting. And then when it comes to a head at the end of the movie, where she makes a decision, she's on a job that causes him, say, some pain from losing his brother. And then the way that turns around by the end, I think it's all really well constructed.
Yeah, I think it's a really tight script for the most part. Mm-hmm. This is one of those movies where you also want to keep an eye on the props, because, like you said, with the characters, you get ideas like these two know each other from something, these two hate each other from something, but then you also want to see the handoff of like the playing card Acapulco Charlie Day's character is playing with, the bottle of alcohol that nurse leaves in the hallway to go pick up the cop. Niece, mm-hmm. Sophia Boutella, goes and grabs that, and then she and Sterling K. Brown have a drink. And like the pen is also something I'd like to talk about, if I could lead us in a slightly different direction. This is one of my criticisms of the film.
Okay.
So the first couple times I watched this, I didn't question the pen is the reason that the Wolf King's coming here, but it's not. The pen ends up being more or less pointless.
This is my big criticism of the film as well.
Yeah. So the pen is a portable vault that Brian Tyree Henry picks up at the very opening of the movie from a guy at a bank they're trying to rob. And they can't open the safe, so they just start robbing the people that are there. And this pen is a portable safe, and it's got a bunch of really valuable diamonds in it. And it belongs to the Wolf King. It's got his little insignia on it. And you get the idea that, well, at least I did. I, foolishly, where was my film analysis? That the Wolf King was coming because he knew his pen was there. Like, you wouldn't not put a tracker and that sort of thing, but that's not it. So the Wolf King has already been targeted and attacked by Niece, who then shot herself to get into the Artemis, who then is going to take him out while he's in the Artemis, because that's the only way she could get him alone. Except, how did she get him in the first place? Were they not alone then?
I wasn't putting that together.
Okay.
That Niece had given him the wound that he has, it's taking him to the Artemis.
I had barely put that together. The thing that I thought was, it's because, so I put in my notes, like, it felt weird. It's like in Pulp Fiction. I kept going back to that. Imagine you got this Marcellus Wallace, and he's got this briefcase, and it's loaded with this gold shit that everybody's like, oh my God, you got this briefcase, it's your ass. You better not let Marcus Wallace come. And then you find out that Marcus Wallace is coming to his private hospital that these people are all staying. And you're like, and everyone's like, oh my God, we better get the fuck out of here before Marcellus Wallace gets here. He's so powerful, he's the king of LA, and he's gonna fuck us all up. And he gets there, and he's just there to get this thing on the back of his neck treated. Like, hey, man, I cut myself shit, and I need to get stitched up. And he never interacts with anybody, and he never. And then, like, his son, that is kind of, like, portrayed as a dumbass, gets into, like, a minor low-stakes deal for the briefcase, but then not really. So it's like, everything kept on, felt like it's escalating and building towards something, and it just was missing that last level.
Kind of like the random feel of that, that, you know, you've got one thing, one reason why the Wolf King should be coming here, but he's not. He's coming here for a different reason. I kind of like that, but I agree with you also. It feels rather inconsequential. It makes that pin feel like, well, what's the point? Just leave that out and we'd have the same problem, kind of.
And it did feel like when they kept on saying, like, he's not even anywhere near the hospital. There's so many other hospitals. And it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, why is he making a point to travel all this way? Why is his son being such an asshole? But it felt like, yeah, this is more of a reprisal for the diamonds than... But yeah, it turns out that was just maybe that was a twist to cover the actual twist, which is Niece, you know, luring him there to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's used as a bargaining chip at the very end of the movie with the Wolf King's son, Crosby, Zachary Quinto. But even that,
so I'm saying, but
it
not
didn't
really
feel like enough of a payoff. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So, and it could have worked without that, right? I mean, this was a violent guy who's probably pissed off that his dad's dead. I mean, he is, obviously.
Well, there's
he
a couple
just
other
wanted
things
to kill them
that,
for that reason.
There's a couple other things that made me feel like there might have been 10 or 15 more minutes of film that they could have filmed and they ran out of money. Because, like, Dave Bautista is like, looks at Zachary Quinto and essentially, your ass is grass and I'm the lawnmower. And that makes me want to see Dave Bautista fucking destroy Zachary Quinto. And I'm waiting for it. I'm waiting for it. All of a sudden, Zachary Quinto squirts out into the parking garage like, ah, I'm going to kill you. Oh, diamonds? And then Dave Bautista's still alive because he turns on the power. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, did he just get away from Dave Bautista? What the fuck?
This is the biggest letdown of the entire movie. I was so excited to see Dave Bautista whip some ass with that axe and then go after Zachary Quinto, and it just never happens. It's promised and it's never delivered, and it was so disappointing.
I do wonder if they just got, like, that shoot got complicated and they're just like, we're out of days and we're out of money and out of stuntmen and we just have to, like, go with what we got. Because, like, I didn't feel that way about Sophia's fight scene. Like, that felt like it was a proper fucking showpiece.
Yes.
But I felt like I only got half the Bautista.
Yeah. Every fight should be a hallway fight. Hallway fights are so good.
They
if we learned anything
so
from Daredevil and Hotel Artemis.
Yeah.
Especially when you got somebody who can really do the action. I mean, some of those kicks that she does, you can tell she's been practicing. I don't know if she's been practicing her entire life, maybe. Maybe she's some kind of dancer. Is she? That makes perfect sense.
Opening
the
move
Jean-Claude
where she
Van
kind
Damme
of
formula.
Like wall climbed and spin kick and put that line in the thing. That was so fucking badass. And that's why I'm saying, like, I was so hungry for the Bautista because he comes under the head of steam like, all right, you guys didn't read the rules. Visiting hours are never. And she's like, don't cross my line. And I'm like, fuck yeah. I want
to
see
and
him.
And I was like, so excited for them to team up. Like the tank and the scalpel, right? Together.
Right.
I wanted to see that.
Yeah.
And it just really let me down there at the end. But that doesn't diminish the movie that much for me. I still really enjoyed it.
That's what I'm saying. It felt like a couple third act connections that they teased and promised never quite got there. Again, this movie is made for under $15 million. This is insane.
Yeah. Speaking of Dave Bautista, what do you guys think of his performance in this?
I liked it. I don't think it was anything.
Best.
Yeah. It wasn't. I wouldn't tell you to watch this movie for Dave Bautista's.
I wouldn't tell you to watch any movie for Dave Bautista.
It's
good at
honestly,
what he does.
Yeah, but it feels
this
like
is Drax. I'm getting like huge Drax energy here.
Drax without the makeup. Yeah, like he is a little simple minded, capable of great violence, but he's also kind of like kept in check by having a larger moral figure, a lot like Amos from like The Expanse.
He's trying to say things in ways that he thinks makes him look smart, like, I will unheal the shit out of you. I mean, it's a hilarious line, but it's very Drax.
Yeah.
There's one moment. So I'm wondering if this is the case with Dave Bautista where he could potentially really shine with less dialogue. I really like his delivery on a lot of things, but there's one moment in the movie where he and Jodie Foster are operating on Jenny Slate and she's getting impatient. She's like, come on, hurry up. And he goes, oh, and he gives her this just like this withering glare that I thought that's where the character of Everest lives. Like he's he's exhausted and stressed because he's an orderly in this penthouse hotel hospital for criminals, but he'll do anything the nurse tells him to do. And then it's also like, why? And then you find out, like, she broke the rules to bring him in as a kid, and she's raised him this entire time, and that's where he gets his devotion from for the place and for Jodie Foster. But I think one of the other actors who...
Well, can I, before we move on from Dave Bautista, because
I
think Dave Bautista's best performance is in, like, Blade Runner 2049, is it?
Yes.
And it's not even close. But the problem is like, I think, and I don't know, I haven't seen The Knock on the Door of the Cabin of the Woods or whatever the hell he was in last year.
So I really don't like anything about Army of the Dead, but I don't think Dave Bautista is the problem there. I think he actually could pull off what they were asking him to do. It's just what they were asking him to do didn't work in any way. But it was more of a quiet, you know, kind of contemplative
but not silly role. Like, you always hear, like, oh, Jim Carrey, he did a serious film, and it's like, oh, my God, didn't know he could do this stuff. I feel like that he is capable of, like, a really fine... I would love to see him get something like The Wrestler. That may be too on the nose for him. Because I think he could crush a really dramatic, serious role. And it's like, you know, this fascination of just, like, the rubber-faced comic that can, like, deliver an Oscar-worthy dramatic performance. Like, seeing this dude who is just a giant slab of meat... emote and like have like a complex emotional interior. I would like to see that. And I kind of, and the thing is Dave Bautista interviews talks like that's what he wants. Like Hollywood won't give it to him because
he's
he is just
that way.
Why the fuck would you, you know, just like why would you give Jim Carrey
he needs to do what Stallone did, right? Because Stallone is that as
well. He's a cop.
Stallone's
he's a cop
the land. Meathead looking dude who can actually pull off a really solid performance dramatically.
The thing is, Stallone started as a
his
like
own stuff.
Writing director. Yeah, he was able to cast himself into the movies that are perfect for him. And I just wish Dave would get that chance because it's not like his window's any close to closing. But like, I'd like to see him, someone give him some challenging material and see if he can knock it out of the park. Because I kind of think he would. Yeah. It'd be super cool to see. Sorry, I didn't mean to hijack that, Tyletho. Where were you steering in terms of other actors?
Well, I was just going to give another example of what I'm talking about. Chevy Chase is not one of my favorite actors by far,
yeah.
But I can appreciate his physical comedy. I think that's where he really excels. Yeah. And that's what I liked about Pierce in Community. And I think I just wanted to say, as someone who loves movies, I think dialogue gets in the way of good storytelling sometimes. I think sometimes it's too much talking, and it's a movie. Just show me. Just show me something. Don't tell me everything. Mm-hmm. Just show it to me. So I think I agree with, I think Dave Bautista could take on some pretty serious roles and really, really kill it. I hope, you know, like Everest does, just killing all over.
Well, I mean, that's one of the, I think, the revelations we've had in action films in the last decade. You look at John Wick, you look at Dredd, you look at Fury Road. They are all minimalist pieces that don't let the dialogue get in the way of what they're trying to do in terms of the story, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree with that. Can we talk about the world building? It's something we all praise, and it's something you know, there's usually I see movies like this, I think in terms of The Matrix, right? The Matrix was this futuristic technology as seen through the prism of like late 80s and early 90s telecommunication gear, you know, rotary phones and modems and stuff like that. I really appreciated that you had this super high-tech 3D printed robot surgeon suites, but it's all kind of grimy and dingy, and the interface looks like it was written for an Apple II. That is what like 1985 elementary school computer interface is what this technology looked like. And again, it's crushing because you've got the trappings, the peripherals of this super high tech future, but it's got this old archaic technology that kind of grounds it and gives it a timeless feel. I think Hotel Artemis will look just as sophisticated in like 2048 as it does in 2018, in the same way the Matrix does.
Yeah, it's a near future sci-fi dystopia, I would say, but maybe too near future. I like, this is 4 years from now, and I know they made this back in 2018, so it was 10 years from then, but I'm not sure if they really thought we'd be having water wars in 10 years or what. But now that we're 4 years out, it seems far less likely to have the privatization of water on the West Coast.
The climate's doing
I wouldn't rule
wild,
it out entirely, but far
stuff,
less likely.
How about nanites? How do you feel about armbands and nanites? Just
we're not there.
That's it. I thought they would go harder in the action scenes because I kept like, oh, all the protagonists are wearing these like armbands of nanites would presumably like auto heal minor injuries. But that never really got to be a thing either.
And we've got camera eyes that have sick telecommunications built in as well that are almost indistinguishable from a real eye visually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's pretty far off, I would say.
She's using to make snuff film pornography mm-hmm. for her clientele.
Yeah. There's also an edge to this movie that I really like in that regard, but
I like Goldblum. I love his death sequence because he's, you know, he's trying to beg, get his way out of it, and she impresses. He's like, you know, essentially, yeah, don't they bought your death, don't give your dignity away for free. And he's like, oh, is this how it's going to be? All right, baby. I forget exactly what he said, but it's like, take me over the rainbow bridge. Send me down the river. Send me down. Yeah, she just slices his throat, looking right in his eyes. And,
I would say she needed to linger on that moment a little longer. If I'm masturbating to the snuff film, I need a little more at the end. I need a little calm down because
I got the idea that this dude has a multi fetish complex because he likes being financially dommed. Because every single time she's calling, she's like, look, you pay pig. I need twice as much money in my bank account or I'm hanging up right now. And it's like always like contract approved. Like she does like three different times. And then like, you can see the guy's probably like he's like almost. But she's like got this kind of disdain, disgust. She's not indulged. Yeah. It's
She did the job. It's over. Yeah.
I think she's domming him, man. Whoever this underworld dude is, she's edging him.
Yeah.
Milking him.
I don't know. I'm trying to please the client if I'm her, and you only get one shot at making this movie. So I don't know. Maybe let the cameras roll a little longer. Just see what happens.
I also, you mentioned about the props, like the Charlie Day card, because, you know, it's like this guy's known for his high-tech weapons and stuff. And I'm like, and he's like, oh, I guess he does have his toys. When he peels the label off, I'm like, what the fuck?
Yep.
What the fuck is this? And then when he slams it into the 3D printer later and it makes a gun, I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I thought that was a super nice cool
connection.
Speaking of 3D printing, I've never seen one. Maybe they exist. But is this the first 3D printer killing ever committed to film?
Let's talk about that.
Please.
2018. Because
it's amazing.
That was the peak of comedy for me. I thought that was hilarious and genius.
Yes.
Because I was so tired of hearing about everybody's damn 3D printer in 2018. Like, okay, I get it. You can print out more plastic. Great. We've got more plastic. I think this so far is the only one. And this movie will forever be the first one to kill someone with a 3D printer. It's a gnarly 3D printer, too. It's got those spouts for the bone, the tissue, and the plasma go straight through his head. And then he just keeps twitching. I feel so sick. Like he's twitching. But I hope, dear listener, I'm not insane. But it's great. I think it was so creative, and I think it was so perfect for the time, too.
Rarely have I seen a plea to the audience that a person's not insane carry the day, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, if you have to say you're not insane.
Yeah, it's one of those Tywin Lannister things. I think it's funny, because that's when someone got killed by 3D printing, I'm like, damn, Jim's always talking about the dangers of the toxic this and time, but I... the idea that the armature would just smash your head flat.
Oh, it does. Little known. You gotta
see, I thought it was
going to
do... Remember in like the first X-Men where like Wolverine was fighting Lady Deathstrike and they're fighting over the adamantium injection table and like he grabs the injector and like shoves it right into her skull and pulls the trigger and you see like liquid metal tears coming out. I actually thought that they would go full tilt with the bone, the tissue, and the plasma, and like those injectors would like... You'd see shit coming out of his ears and eye holes, but...
They should have had him roll over, fall out of the machine, and get a close up of that. Yeah, that would have been cool.
He's just got a liver on the side of his face now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like a gun half embedded in his skull or something. That would have been. Yeah.
Is that going to be? Are we going to see that in the next 10 years? Someone strapped to a 3D tissue printing table, and they're going to do like Agent Smith in the Matrix, to stitch over your mouth with flesh, so you just suffocate yourself.
Yeah, or thrown into like an industrial size one, and you come out looking like the Fly or something.
Yeah, you've had some modifications made.
Right, I'll get on writing that script. Me and Talitha apparently need to write that script together.
Yep,
because we're both broken in the same way.
Yeah, I'll the horror pussy will sit that one out. That's sounds like the whole concept's going to hell in a handbasket full of blood and shit. Another one of the great lines in this movie.
Yeah, I'm someone who likes to watch with captions on.
Same.
Because I love to pick up all the little things. Like, Jodie Foster's too damn sweet. I didn't hear that the first couple of times I watched the movie. I just think the little things that her character has, she almost says it under her breath in a way that I just wasn't hearing without the captions. So I recommend captions on so you pick up all the little gems that are in this movie.
Yeah, I did watch this with captions on. I usually don't. But yeah, I don't know that I would have picked up the Too Damn Sweet and all of her little embellishments of language there.
So funny because like Toot Sweet is not something you hear every day. And last night I just happened to watch American in Paris again. And motherfucking Gene Kelly hits us with the Toot Damn Sweet. And then I like had a stroke when Jodie Foster said it like 8 hours later. Like, wow, what a wild run of Toot Sweet.
One of my favorite lines, just because of how stupid it is when Charlie Day is, I don't know if he thinks he's hitting on Niece or if he's just an asshole to everybody and this is the way he goes, but he calls her a street taco. He says, "You're a street taco, I'm a 20 ounce sirloin." I thought that was hilarious. It's such a dumb line.
And then he calls her street meat again later.
He does, yeah.
Street meat?
Uh-huh.
It's like a stray cat? What?
Like taco. What street, like a street,
what's the concept of street
taco?
Meat?
Like a street food. Right? Because you sit down to eat a sirloin. You don't have to eat a taco.
I thought it was fun to see. I mean, Charlie Day's doing his Charlie Day thing.
Kinda. It's different, for sure.
Yeah. It's definitely more of a psychopath mixed in there. Mm-hmm. Like, Charlie learned a lot from Dennis and then became an arms dealer. And then now here we are in 2028. And I was trying to figure out if this guy actually believes anything he's saying. Because, you know, he showboats a lot. At least to me, it's showboating. Mm-hmm. I don't think this guy has anything to back it up with. And he's an arms dealer. He keeps talking about his toys. And then he finally gets the gun. And he's like, this can't aim for shit. I mean, granted, it was printed.
Mm-hmm. Out of bone and tissue.
Yeah.
Never forget but that.
Every watch, I'm looking for a clue as to whether this guy is as delusional as I think he is, or if there's anything actually scary about him.
He has a lot of money. To be subscribed to the Artemis and the Anywhere helicopter service and all that stuff. But it's also like arms dealer, you know, the merchant of death's like that's you could definitely make a lot of money, but you probably don't get your hands dirty. Like arms dealers are not the John Wicks of the world. They're the people who supply the nations that John Wick goes in to kill. So it's like maybe
they're
it's
salesmen?
That. It's like he's, it's not that he's all talk. It's just that he doesn't really belong in this world. He's more of an executive that's gone bad than he is an assassin who's going professional. Which that's the other thing with the conversation they had with Niece and Waikiki, the idea of like professionalism, like you're a professional, I'm the business.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Day is like, yeah, he's like a Fortune 500 type deal. He doesn't belong in the rough and tumble world.
But for the underworld, I mean, he's making deals with probably bad people all the time. He's an underworld salesman is what I view him as.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder how he's still alive because his demeanor seems like it's just tailor-made to piss people off.
Oh, and yeah. He's very punchable.
Yeah, if he talks like this to somebody who he's selling guns to, they're probably just going to murder him.
Yeah, thanks for the product, bang.
Yeah, or I just don't like you, bang, you're dead.
Yeah, this guy's just so stupid and loud. How does he survive making the deals that he has to make?
Yeah. But I don't know, maybe he's just like this in this scenario, and when he's doing business, he's much cooler. He's, I don't know. But I like Charlie Day's performance here. I think it it's kind of underselling it to say that Charlie Day is doing his Charlie Day thing here, because he's striking me as somebody who has reason to have swagger, not physically. I mean, I don't think he could kick anybody's ass in here, but he probably knows a lot of really connected, really bad people. He probably feels like he's kind of the Wolf King in his own way. And he's really pulling that off for somebody who most of the time is just a complete buffoon. I mean, Charlie Day plays idiots and just complete clowns. I didn't feel any of the clown coming through here. I felt like this is a guy who is a hothead, who runs off at the mouth, probably deserves to be punched or worse, but clown I was not getting. So he kind of impressed me that way.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. And now, back with more Bald Move. Did they break every single rule in this movie? I wrote them all down because there's a brief shot of a poster, a sign that's posted.
You were able to make out the last rule? Because I couldn't make out the last rule. It's too dark.
Hotel Artemis rules are final and non-negotiable is the final one. But there are 10 rules. I'm maybe going to run through all these and sure. You can just give me a yes or no if you think they were broken in this movie. Number one, while on the premises, no fighting with or killing other patients.
Super broke.
Okay. Number two, no disrespectful words or actions allowed against Hotel Artemis staff. Well, Charlie Day is in this.
Yeah. And Quinto is the one to bust that one down.
Right.
Oh, I mean, Charlie Day.
They
does
don't actually
too, the way
so they don't
act.
So they don't actually get access to the hotel. They break in. Does that count as that itself is a violation? But I guess that's being
it is. Yeah, memberships. Prior but lapsed members will not be admitted. I mean,
is that one that didn't get broke?
Well, so is anybody a prior
oh, no,
or
no,
lapsed
no, no,
member.
That cop is not a member at all. But she's not a prior or
but
lapsed.
But she's never been.
Yeah. I think that breaks the no guests rule.
Yes.
Yeah. But this is, I can't think of anyone who has a lapsed membership that got in, unless one of those dudes that was rolling the Zachary Quinto, but...
Yeah, that
I
one wasn't
right.
explicitly broken.
I don't think five was. No guns or any type of weapon permitted through the gates. Obviously, that got broken.
Broke.
No photography or video allowed.
Well, I mean, she got her eyeball.
Niece had
her,
had her implant. Mm-hmm.
Okay, how about this? No outside food or drink. Anybody bringing burgers in?
That might be a unbroken law.
I think so.
Or that too.
Guess it depends on what you mean by food and drink.
Yeah.
What
do
you mean by food and drink?
I don't know. We'll have to ask Drew Pierce.
Okay. How about if number nine, if member is found to have compromised or led to compromise of location, membership will be revoked. I mean, that's not a rule you can break. That's just a thing that happens.
Yeah.
It was certainly like when she let a civilian in, like somebody broke, like, you know, annoying sister from Parks and Rec found out about this because her son's shitty op security, I guess.
Oh, so did Jodie Foster break that rule and that's why she couldn't go back?
Wait, how could she have broken that? No, wait.
She brought in Morgan.
Her son couldn't have told her that because her son was dead before she found the Hotel Artemis. So, because she surmised that it must be like a legend on the streets that a savvy cop on a beat long enough would kind of put two and two together. Is that what happened?
I think sounds so. Like it. I think, Jim, to your question where you're asking why Jodie Foster didn't go back at the end, I think she didn't go back because that helping people was built on a lie. Mm-hmm. That what she was doing at the Artemis, I think she felt like she was in another trap there because of how the Wolf King may or may not have orchestrated things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't think it's
that makes
rule.
Sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the very end of this movie when, you know, Sterling K. Brown, Waikiki, and Jodie Foster get out of the Hotel Artemis, get to a car, and he drives away, and she kind of walks into the smoke or the city or whatever there playing her song. I really like that. The movie kind of has dual protagonists in Sterling K. Brown and Jodie Foster.
True.
Throughout its run. They do a lot of building of relationships between those characters and some of the more minor characters in this movie. And it really, there was a kind of mirroring of the two that happens in the movie where they both have baggage. One has baggage of a lost loved one. The other has baggage of a still living loved one who's just like dragging them down at every turn. And by the end, they're both free of that. I felt like the way they got around to that was pretty elegant for what is an otherwise silly action movie.
Yeah. And then I think we talked earlier about, was this meant to continue as a series? She does send him off in the direction of the dark room in Las Vegas. So
yeah.
I think there was a little bit of hope there that this was going to develop into multi-part.
Especially because, like, why the mid-credit sequence where Sophia Boutella escapes? Like, why have that if they didn't have plans for a sequel? And I thought maybe, that you'd have Dave Bautista anchoring something at the Hotel Artemis, or they could continue with the Vegas. You know, maybe it's your fallen star. But the thing is I don't think Sterling K. Brown is staying in this life. Like, the only reason he got back in is to help his brother out.
Yeah.
And I feel like that he's going to go legit. Like, he's, like, smart and resourceful. And so it's like, you'd have to build around Dave, I guess. Or I guess, Sterling can just keep getting into misadventures that lead him to be back on the wrong side of the law.
Yeah, but what pulls him back into it? Because I get the sense that his brother fucking up all the time and holding him back from succeeding was one of the things that pushed him back into that life.
I like that because he's like, you know, his whole thing is like, I've got a plan. No matter what happens, he's got a plan. And he's like, you know, I've got all these plans. My life's had all these plans, but they're all really the plan to, like, to save you. And like at the end of the movie, he's like he even says, like, I think for the first time in my life, I got like a clean slate. I can't remember what exactly he said, but he's like, I've got a clean slate that I can do whatever I want to do. So it'd be kind of tragic if he got pulled back into the life, but
yeah,
it does feel
yeah.
like he had plans for more.
His only connection to this underworld is Nice now, and she's survived, but I don't think they're getting back together. That seemed a little toxic.
Yeah. So what is their backstory? They had some kind of romantic relationship, and at some point she decided she was going overseas somewhere, and he doesn't do overseas. I got the impression he doesn't do overseas because his brother is here and he's not willing to leave his brother. And she was kind of, by moving away and inviting him to come with, she was kind of giving him an ultimatum, like, stop letting your brother ruin and rule your life and come with me and we'll do better, bigger stuff.
That's the vibe I got too.
All right. I was just checking because they don't spell it out exactly, but they do drop a lot of small hints throughout their conversations.
Yeah.
Which I liked.
What are the other rules?
There are only a few we didn't talk about. Like I said, Hotel Artemis rules, final and non-negotiable. Memberships must be paid for in full and in advance, which I
that
mean, I guess that rule
broken.
Doesn't get broken.
Yeah, yeah, but we saw the guy at the beginning didn't keep up on his membership and he was sent outside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, not really broken, but definitely present. But that's kind of it. Absolutely no visitors. The one you mentioned, Talitha, that gets broken for sure. Broken by Jodie Foster. I mean, she brings in Mo. Yeah.
She also like broke through. That's I also like, again, there's so much. This movie is kind of an iceberg movie. There's so much beneath that never makes it to the screen. But the, you know, I broke the rules before and that worked out okay. And Dave's like, well, I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting that like he was some kind of street urchin that was in a bad way and she took in, which is why he's such a loyal puppy dog to her. Like, it's essentially his surrogate mother.
Which, does the timing work out for that? How old do you think he's supposed to be in this movie? Because it was 22 years ago she started Hotel Artemis.
Uh-huh. I think it does. Like, she'd do that in her 40s, and Dave Bautista was like... How old is Dave Bautista? I thought he was, like, early 40s.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
Think
like, if that was 22 years ago, he would have been in his late teens.
Oh, shit, he's 55 years old. Fuck.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I felt to me like he was that guy playing his mid to late 30s. So, like, he could
okay,
be anywhere
could
between
yeah.
5 and 15 when she picked him up. And either yeah. one of those, I think, are fine. Or he could have been in a gang, you know, like 15-year-old kind of jit type of deal. But
yeah, I suppose that works. We didn't talk about the vault in enough detail for my taste. Is a portable vault a good idea in the first place?
Is a what?
A portable vault. A good idea.
Are the diamonds worth anything if you can't get them out?
No, but are they worth anything if you lose the vault? Like, you do your car keys or your sunglasses or... like, I know it'd be a priority not to lose this thing, but you could just misplace $18 million worth of diamonds because your vault is super light and portable.
It seems like you would have, like, tracking, though. Like, that... pin is
totally.
So fucking huge. Yeah. You could easily have like some kind of LoJack GPS tracker, but
and I want to say maybe there is tracking. Everybody's like when they see this pin and they know what it is, they are super urgent about leaving.
Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, who would know that they necessarily have it and where they are at any given time unless there was tracking.
Yeah, and if you're like if you saw that on the street and you picked it up and you're just a civilian, you wouldn't be like, oh my God, this is the Wolf King. He's a feared. You'd just be like, holy shit, pin full of diamonds, you know?
Uh-huh. Or just a really
it does
nice
seem,
pin.
It does seem like that would be something that it's nice. It's, maybe it's good for like international smuggling, but like can't beat the old steel briefcase handcuffed to a thug, you know?
Right.
They're going to lose that.
Yeah, or a truck.
And
all
here's the thing
I
had.
But...
why the fuck would you put it on your outside suit pocket?
Yeah. Hide in plain sight, baby.
Hubris.
Or prison pocket. It's like, you know, like it's ergonomically designed for that purpose, but you put it on your front shirt pocket, you're asking to be robbed. You know?
He was going to the bank. I mean, how are you going to deposit that?
Yeah, safe deposit. Maybe it's a safe deposit thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also, now that we're nitpicking, does the Wolf King, is like, he stores his ill-gotten goods in safety deposit boxes and banks?
In the middle
like, during
of
a riot,
in a
he
city
sends
that's...
his low-level yeah. employees, like, oh, I got 18 million of diamonds. Take, like, he is... what riot is busting into the Wolf King's fortress, man?
Maybe he's
also,
leaving LA.
Hmm. Bring
the diamonds.
Diamonds
with you.
Yeah.
Also, does $18 million worth of fancy diamonds make you a kingpin? Make you the owner of LA? Because there are people in LA with a lot more than $18 million. Like, at the end, when Zachary Quinto is threatening him, telling him, give me the pin, I'm going to kill Jodie Foster, he tempts him with, like, here's $18 million worth of diamonds that will make you the king of LA.
Oh, Crosby's an idiot, though.
Crosby's an idiot, but also $18 million okay. would go a long way. Like, if you were the less loved son of a gangster, it'd probably go a good way of getting you established, buying you some muscle, if you were smart.
And it's a hard currency, as opposed to, you know, potentially, if the system is falling out here in LA, nobody's going to have access to their digital money, maybe, but...
True.
$18 million.
But some
you
of that stuff, it's
LA.
Like the gold coins and John Wick, like, you know, that's a cool, sick idea, but does it really, you know, if you think about the scrutiny and how much a gold coin is worth in one movie versus the other, you know, like how do you have a market based on favors anyway?
Yeah, I think the gold coin thing is more about keeping people civil. And that's, I think that's their main purpose.
Yeah. But, the weird yellow diamonds. Are now yellow diamonds super valuable? Because I thought that was like the shit tier diamond. You know, like is people like fuck color now?
I mean, good enough marketing, they can sell anything.
Yeah.
We have the
rocks.
Ability to create diamonds at scale now out of nothing, essentially, and yet people still view real diamonds, quote unquote real diamonds, with artificial scarcity as extra valuable. So
I feel like the millennials and the Gen Zers are busting busting De Beers balls. They're done.
I hope so.
They're running out of town.
I don't want a diamond ever. Give me a river rock.
Neither do I.
I'll have more fun with that.
But what if you had a 5-carat piss yellow African conflict diamond that
Yakusha
came from
diamond.
Zachary Quinto's fat pin.
Would it make me rule
when
Los
I saw
Angeles?
That pin, yeah, when I saw that pin, I just thought of those giant pins you used to have in school that had like the four colors, you know? It's like, oh man,
it doesn't
must
even
have
that.
That must have eight colors. It's so fat. Yeah, you get room for eight colors in that barrel.
I hope that pen writes in yellow, so it's completely pointless.
Yeah.
It's a safe that can get stolen with ink you can't read.
Two more things here. The Wolf King symbol looks an awful lot like the Thundercat symbol. Just saying.
It looks a lot like the whatever Witcher house that the Geralt fights under too.
Yep. Yeah.
It was very the Witcher.
And then Nice is about to go into a hallway fight, so she stuffs scalpels into her boots. Scalpels in your boots. Just think about it for a second. Scalpels in your boots.
Pain is just a mindset to Nice.
Blade down. Blade
but yeah,
down
it doesn't
too.
Make sense.
Yeah.
Also, I would like to point out, as a woman who loves to watch action, I love that she's wearing boots. I love that she's wearing boots.
Not high heels.
Oh my gosh. I got rid of I used to have some high heels. I tried them out. They're not for me. They make my knees hurt. I can barely walk in them. No, that's not true. I can walk fine, okay? But it's like, I don't want to walk in them. And so when I see fight scenes in high heels, I'm just like, oh, like I start getting sore. So I like the boots. Not a great place for scalpels, but I like the boots.
Maybe she's an assassin, right? And she does throw blades. Maybe her boots have built-in sheaths. She has slipped them in the existing throwing knife.
Like a little internal pocket.
Stabbing her ankles with monomolecular nanite blades or whatever the fuck those electro scalpers were.
Microwave blades. Yeah.
Microwave blades. Holy shit. Or microwave blades.
Here's what you got to do. If you are wearing high heels and you're about to get into a fight, take them off. I always love a scene where, you know, the girly girl who's about to kick ass removes the high heels before they get into the fight. It's like, I'm way more effective this way. And also, my bare feet are going to kick your ass.
Plus, I can't remember what it might have been, the nice guys, but I saw a movie this week where a lady was in a fight with high heels and she took the high heel off and did the whole 4-inch spike into a dude's eye socket. Yeah, they're also dead. They're also deadly. They're stilettos. You got 4-inch dirks on your heels.
Yeah.
But she's got scalpels in her boots, so what does she need for that?
Then you have multiple blades too, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's going to do it for our coverage here of Hotel Artemis. Thanks to Talitha, number one, for producing all of our podcasts, but also for having us watch this awesome movie.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is now, I think, the third bald move thing you've done in front of the mic, so that's cool.
Yeah.
We'll see about getting you back on sooner than, you know, several months or however long the interval's been. But it's been a lot of fun. We will be back with another pulp movie or project before you know it. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Talitha.
See you next time.